Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
You know, in life, no matter how much you are down, if you are willing to give your best and fight, you know, you can always have a fighting chance to come back.
We had to rise from the ashes.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. For this week's edition, I've been hearing about a new form of gene therapy that doesn't involve editing DNA, all the rage these days, but uses a cell's own mechanisms to silence troublesome proteins.
The most common way that drugs work is by turning off or inhibiting proteins that are contributing to disease. And so for all of those, the epigenetics approaches in principle could be used as a sort of more permanent solution.
I've also been hearing about attempts at lab-driven evolution to protect corals from future global warming and the remarkable journey of a remarkable butterfly.
They have traveled a minimum of 4,200 kilometers at least over the ocean with no possible stops, and this journey probably extends up to 7,000 kilometers.
We start with promising news in the fight against HIV. Antivirals mean that infection with the virus is no longer a death sentence. Although it's not eradicated from a patient's body, it can't replicate and harm the immune system. But in the absence of a vaccine, the virus does continue to spread to new victims. There are still around a million new cases each year. The good news is the early conclusion of a trial of a preventive treatment called lenacapavir, reporting early because the statistics from the trial showed it was so good at protecting young women from infection. The approach is what they call PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, normally a daily regimen of pills in sexually active people, but in this case, an injectable taken just twice a year. Linda Gale Becker of the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation coordinated the South African arm of the trial and first reminded me of the logic of PrEP.
This is the notion, a little bit like we would use antimalarials if we travel to a country where malaria is endemic. You take an antiretroviral agent prior to potential exposure to HIV, and the antiviral is on board in the tissues, and then it prevents HIV infection should you be exposed to HIV. So it's important that the antiretroviral is in the correct tissue level, drug level, at the time of exposure for it to work.
And that's typically a daily pill, but the one you've been working on, well, it's an injection.
Correct. So in 2012, the FDA approved the oral PrEP agent, which is made up of two antiretrovirals. One is called tenofovir diphosphate, the other one emtricitabine. And we have had that now for more than 10 years. So that requires daily ingestion of the pill or a notion of event-driven pill taking. So it's an interesting regimen where you take two pills 48 hours before sex, one pill 12 hours late and another pill a day after that. So that has been recommended only for men. So we haven't had anything other than a daily pill for women until very recently. And one of the difficulties with taking something daily, of course, is it needs habituation. People need to get into that realm of taking a pill daily. Particularly busy young people sometimes struggle to do that. And so we have found that adherence to a daily regimen hasn't been great. And so we haven't seen the kinds of results we would hope to see with prevention with oral pills. So the world has been looking for a less frequently dosed option. Most recently, this has been in the form of a depot injectable strategy, where an injection is either given into the muscle or into the subcutaneous tissues. The one you only have to take 6 times a year, so every 2 months. The most recent, you only have to take twice a year. So it actually is a 6-monthly injectable that prevents HIV if you have the injections on board.
And you've been trying this one now in young women. Give us a sense of that trial.
This is an agent called lenacapavir. It is a capsid inhibitor. It's given in an injectable form subcutaneously. The preferred place is just under the skin in the abdomen region or into the thigh. And it only has to be given twice a year. So we have been trialing it in a phase 3 in South Africa and Uganda amongst just over 5,000 women. And that trial has just been recommended to stop by the Independent Data Safety Managing Board because there has just been such an outstanding success in the arm that was the injectable compared to the oral pill arm that the DSMB feels that it is ethically correct to now stop the randomized phase of the trial and offer the injectable to all the participants.
You're saying it's cut short because it's already proved so successful.
Correct, exactly that. So we're moving now into what we call the open label phase, where people can choose to use the injectable even if they were assigned to the oral pill arm in the trial.
I mean, how successful is successful in this case?
Well, in over 2,000 young women, we did not see a single HIV infection, which even as I tell you that today, that kind of makes the hair on my arms go up because we just have never seen this before. So it's 100% effective compared to the other active arm. The other arm was not placebo. It was an oral pill arm. So that's in comparison to oral PrEP.
I suppose I'm really surprised you can take an injection that still is effective after several months. I mean, this is a very high dose. Is it a slow release thing or what?
Yes. You know, the formulation is organized so that it has slow release from a kind of a little pellet. And the antiretrovirals leak out over a long period of time, in this case, 6 months, before you start to see those levels drop to a point where it's no longer going to be effective. So as long as you're getting it 6-monthly, you have enough drug leaking out into the tissues in order to stay in that protective realm.
I mean, I can see why that's so much better than a daily pill, because it's so easy for any of us to forget that daily pill, particularly when you're not even ill. You're just hoping not to get ill. From your position at the Desmond Tutu Centre, you must have a sense of how important this kind of prevention must be in the absence of an effective vaccine.
Well, you know, we just have not seen incidents in young women and young people who, for example, young men who have sex with men or young transgender people, we have just not seen the incidence turn. Despite the fact that we've had fantastic antiretrovirals, we've definitely seen improvement in treatment outcomes, in death rates, but that new infection rate, this has been a really tough nut to crack. And I am very hopeful that, you know, with this kind of tool, we can now offer this to young people. They can use it discreetly. And I think this can be game changing in terms of turning those infection rates. You know, in South Africa, we see about 2,000 young women infected with HIV every week. This is not a small problem. It is a big problem to sort out. And I'm, for the first time, I'm particularly hopeful.
What about the cost of this? I mean, I don't know how many people you want to see getting this treatment. There's presumably some kind of issue with targeting it, but also antiretrovirals are typically quite expensive. So, you know, it's going to be affordable.
That's the critical thing. I have no doubt it's cost effective. Whether it is going to be affordable is really the biggest question of all. And we're waiting to see what the originator, what the pharma does. To date, they have put out public statements saying that they will be doing everything they can to ensure access, particularly to the countries that have contributed to the phase 3 trial. So that would be Uganda and South Africa, but also that they will offer these as licenses to generic companies, which obviously is a great way to ensure that we do get this in an affordable way. Without this getting into the hands of young people, it obviously cannot work.
Linda Gale-Becker, clearly thrilled. A hot, hot topic in medical science these days is gene therapy, particularly gene editing. We've devoted whole episodes of Science in Action to the topic. The Nobel Prize-winning CRISPR-Cas editing allows clinicians to put molecular machinery into a patient's cells, which will find the precise sequence of DNA letters where a cut or repair needs to be made. But nature uses another form of gene regulation called epigenetics, literally on the gene, which leaves the DNA intact but effectively hides part of it from the cell. By linking that mechanism to the precision of CRISPR, Jonathan Weissman and team have developed an experimental treatment for the brain condition Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a proof of principle that could be extended to many diseases. CJD, he says, like mad cow disease, scrapie and kuru, results from a malfunctioning protein called prion.
Prion diseases act like an infectious agent, but they're not viruses and they're not bacteria. They're actually a protein that's causing the infection. And the basic essence of this is you have a natural protein in most cells, in your brain cells, your neurons, that normally is in a form that's healthy and doesn't cause disease, but it can misfold into an infectious disease-causing form. And this form can propagate itself. It can catalyze the conversion of your natural protein. And so you can get these prion diseases by eating prions. Then that's, of course, how mad cow is transmitted. You can get it just spontaneously, and that's the most common way. Or you can get it by inheriting a mutation that makes your prion protein more likely to misfold.
And the problem is that you keep on producing these prion proteins in your brain, but they also become misfolded, and that's how the disease develops.
That's exactly right. So that's both the problem and the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And why that's the solution is, it turns out mammals can do quite well without this prion protein. So as long as you turn off the natural source, the disease can't propagate.
Now, what really attracted me about this paper that you just published is that we've talked an awful lot on the program about gene therapies and gene editing. This one is gene therapy, but it's not actually gene editing. It's a sort of a rather more gentle approach to regulating that gene.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what we're doing is not changing your DNA at all. So we're not making mutations or cutting your DNA, but rather just turning off a gene. And we're using a natural system that your body has.
It's called epigenetics. I think of it maybe as a kind of molecular version of insulation tape that you put on electrical wiring. It doesn't cut the wire, but it wraps it up.
Yeah, I think that's a nice analogy. You know, one way to think of this is every cell in our body has the same DNA, the same instructions, but your skin is very different from your muscle. So your skin never produces the motors that your muscle cells use. The skin cells have ways of preventing that muscle protein from ever being made. And we're using these natural systems for basically taking the neurons and making sure that they can never produce a prion protein.
So you're using this small virus, adeno-associated virus, and that carries in just enough genetic instruction, is it, that then triggers these natural processes in the right place, in the right cells, on the right part of the DNA?
Yeah, that's correct. So the real challenge of this editing field is, how do you deliver your instructions to all the cells that you need and to deliver this efficiently and safely? And these AAVs, or adeno-associated viruses, are particularly good, almost uniquely good, at delivering these messages to your brain cells, to your neurons.
Is that because they're small?
They're small viruses, but they can't take long instructions.
Aha. And is that part of the trick then, that you're using natural mechanisms which are already there in the cells, you're just sort of provoking them, triggering them with this adeno-associated virus trigger?
That's right. So there's a lot of interest, rightly so, in CRISPR-Cas9 as a genome editing and even epigenome editing tool. But this is a very big protein that's very difficult to deliver by these AAV viruses. So instead, what we're doing is delivering a much smaller protein that really is sort of an adapter. It just binds to the DNA, and then it grabs your natural machinery for shutting down genes. So all we have to do is put this little adapter in, and that the adapter very nicely fits into an AAV.
And then, like gene editing, this process identifies the right bit of all the DNA to say, right, stop producing this prion protein.
That's right. So our adapter has two parts. One part is the part that finds the right piece of DNA, and the second part recruits in the silencing machinery that tells that gene to turn off.
And you've done these experiments in mice. So just so I'm clear, presumably these mice didn't have the animal form of a prion disease, but you're able to see that it worked.
What we're able to see is that we can get rid of the prion protein in the vast majority of the neurons. And we know from a lot of work that's been done on prions that if you, even in an animal that's sick with a prion disease, if you can turn off the prion protein, that's enough to halt the disease. We have ongoing experiments where we're actually infecting mice with a prion and then coming in to see if we can rescue that mice. Once it's sick, rescue it with our adeno-associated virus.
So we'll have to wait for those results. But this sounds very promising. Is the process you're using adaptable to other brain diseases where, I don't know, there might be other proteins which you'd like to regulate, things like Alzheimer's? I don't know if Parkinson's or disease like that might be appropriate for this kind of approach?
Yes. Yeah, so we think any disease in which there's a natural protein that's contributing to the disease process could be applicable. So there's certainly targets, proteins that we'd like to turn down in Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, perhaps even more clearly in Huntington's disease.
And protein diseases in other parts of the body outside the brain?
Yes, absolutely. So the most common way that drugs work is by turning off or inhibiting proteins that are contributing to disease. And so for all of those, you know, small molecules like Lipitor for lowering cholesterol and all the other drugs out there that are really just turning off proteins that are contributing to disease, the epigenetics approaches in principle could be used as a sort of more permanent solution.
Jonathan Weissman of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research in Massachusetts. His CHARM gene therapy is described in detail in Science This Week. And this is your reminder, you're listening to Science in Action from the BBC. And from treating people to treating corals. It's only a few months since we were talking about the summer heat stress that was threatening the coral reefs all round Australia, including the Great Barrier Reef. And now it's clear how much harm was done.
The bleaching event that we experienced this summer is the most extensive on record. And it's the fifth mass bleaching event since 2016. So it's very fair to say that in the last decade, the Great Barrier Reef has been placed under a lot of ecological strain.
And these bleaching events happen because the coral animals depend on little microalgae that they absorb, that's symbiosis, and that feed them.
That's absolutely correct. And by definition, bleaching is the loss of those algae. So when the water temperature exceeds some threshold, for somewhat unknown reasons, actually, this is an open question, the coral expels those obligate symbionts. And so essentially it goes into a point where it's at risk. So if it doesn't have the symbionts, which provide it with most of the energy it needs to grow, the coral essentially begins to starve.
That's Matthew Nitschke of the Australian Institute of Marine Science, AIMS. The bleaching he talks of occurs because healthy coral animals need light-capturing algae inside them to get nourishment, and excessive heat destroys that symbiosis. But Matthew believes that by accelerating the evolution of algae in his lab, they can help make corals resilient against future global warming.
We call this experimental evolution. Essentially, we are taking the natural process, what occurs on the reef, which is natural selection for example, the heat-tolerant symbionts that a coral requires to survive under increased, let's say, climate projections, higher seawater temperatures. But when we grow the symbiont outside of the coral, we give it everything it needs to divide very rapidly. And so we can find the few beneficial mutations amongst the population of many millions of cells that result in withstanding higher temperatures. So in the lab, we've been able to increase the temperature resilience of the coral symbionts to levels of heat exposure that they would have never experienced on the Great Barrier Reef, in the history of the Great Barrier Reef, in fact, which is, you know, on the order of about 10,000 years old.
This is sort of unnatural selection of the fittest. You find the ones that still survive when you keep on putting up the temperatures. I mean, are you able to do these experiments with corals in the lab as well? Because it's for one thing for these algae to survive in water at high temperatures, but the process presumably needs for the corals to take them up again.
That's correct. So our aim as part of the reef restoration and adaptation program is that every coral we would deploy as part of a restoration initiative would contain those heat-evolved symbionts. And there's an interesting thing that corals do. Many corals, when they start their life, do not have these symbionts at all. They have to acquire them from the surrounding environment. And so when we're rearing corals, little baby corals that are around the size of just a few millimeters in diameter, they're kind of a blank slate. So we can give them these heat-evolved symbionts at that point in their life history that they carry with them as they're deployed onto the reef.
You're writing in this review article about quite a few experiments that have presumably been going on for a number of years. Do you see promise in the experiments that you've done so far, and you and your colleagues have done so far, that this may be an option?
Absolutely. And there's been no indication to the contrary so far that this technique has potential. As we detail in the review, we've been able to push the thermal limit of these coral symbionts to levels that the wild-type counterparts, what we grow them at normal temperatures, just cannot withstand. They cannot grow under these temperatures. And so the potential of this to be scaled, which is perhaps the real question, I think that we've got the proof of concept in the lab and our trials with juvenile and adult corals. But can we scale this to a meaningful intervention, sort of size and what we can actually deliver? We would also need to make advances in the time it takes to reach this enhanced phenotype. Our best effort so far is that it takes around a couple of years of thermal selection to raise this sort of ceiling in terms of what they can handle. But 2 years is still pretty good, in my opinion, considering that the lifespan of a single coral from the day it's born to when it can reproduce again is sort of on the minimum around 5 years, just to achieve one generation in the coral.
So essentially, the scale-up is you've got to be able to do on land what the vastness of the Great Barrier Reef does naturally under natural conditions.
Yes, but the growing algae is very inexpensive. And so when we talk about the scale, and if we needed to deploy millions of corals onto the reef to restore some area, let's say some small area of reef, well, we would need to get that cost per coral down as low as possible, right? It would have to be just a dollar or even less per coral to be able to make meaningful inroads into the number of, let's say, the trajectory of that reef. But growing enough symbiont cells to inoculate a single coral juvenile would just cost a few cents. Really, well, you need a bit of seawater. We need the nutrients to put in that seawater. Of course, there's the R&D cost to develop the culture and to grow them and to understand whether we've reached that new ceiling of thermal tolerance. But we wouldn't necessarily be the practitioners of the restoration. We would provide the symbiont cultures that the practitioner would then grow and use. And we only need a few thousand cells to inoculate a single coral, and I can get that from less than a milliliter of seawater, just a very small amount of seawater, in fact.
Matthew Nitschke, who recorded Progress on Building Coral Resilience in the latest issue of Trends in Microbiology. We end with a great journey for a tiny creature. The creature is the Painted Lady Butterfly, actually already known to be a remarkable traveller, moving between Arctic and Central Europe and tropical Africa. But this journey beats that, as ecologist Gerard Talavera told me.
They have travelled a minimum of 4,200 kilometers at least over the ocean with no possible stops, and this journey probably extends up to 7,000 kilometers if we consider their natal origin in Western Europe.
This is absolutely enormous, and that 4,200 kilometers, that's across the Atlantic Ocean.
Correct. That's the minimum distance they traveled if we trace a straight line from the collecting point in South America to the closest possible point in Western Africa.
This whole story starts with you seeing some of these butterflies on the north coast of South America.
Yes, and that happened in 2013 when I was doing some fieldwork in French Guiana coast. But it was not random. I was there because there were some previous reports on people spotting this species in similar regions in South America. And part of my trip was to go and try the impossible. So, yeah, the work was basically I was monitoring the beach in the mornings. And when I saw them, actually found them the very last day before I was back home.
How many?
I observed around 10 of them, and I could capture 3. So probably this number was a lot larger.
So that's just the beginning of the scientific study that you did, because the most important thing is these are not native to South America, these butterflies.
Exactly. And that was the end of their journey, but just the beginning of our journey, scientific journey, to try to understand what happened here, because the only possibility was that they were migrants, and there were basically two options. One is the closest established populations are probably North America or Central America. And another option was that they came from the old world in Europe or in Africa.
And the first thing you did was to use genetics, and that ruled out a North American origin, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. But still, this information wouldn't tell us if those particular individuals were actual migrants or were the offspring of previous migrants. Because they could have been migrated before and suddenly established or have or reproduced in South America, and then we were just capturing the offspring.
But it's not like these butterflies arrived with passports.
Correct. There's no passports. They don't understand about borders.
So what else could you find?
So, in order to find proof those individuals were migrants, we developed a technique to sequence the pollen grains that the butterflies were carrying in their bodies.
Pollen?
Pollen, yeah.
So they just pick this up?
Yes, when they visit flowers, they just get attached pollen grains from the flowers, and this is how they pollinate other plants.
And so the pollen is effectively the passport, is it? It told you where they'd been.
Correct, yeah, that might be passport. Because what we found was that among the different plants we detected, we sequenced the DNA of this pollen, we detected some plants that were native from West Africa. So that was proof that this butterfly visited flowers in West Africa.
Blimey. I mean, I just think that's fantastic. So the scientific work involved in picking individual pollen grains off these butterflies, analysing them. I mean, it's fantastic sort of detective work.
Totally detective work, yes.
And then you also looked at what they'd been eating or something. You also did some isotopes. You're looking at some of the specific elements they had.
Exactly, yeah. That's another of the tools we had to develop during these years, because the pollen grains were telling us that these butterflies were in West Africa at some point, but what is not telling us is where they were raised. They could be born in some other region. So what isotope techniques tell us is exactly that, where these butterflies develop as caterpillars. We analyzed some of the stable isotopes on the wings of the butterflies that they captured from the plants that they eat when they are caterpillars. And these plants at the same time capture it from the soil. So if we know information about the spatial distribution of these isotopes on Earth, we can infer where these butterflies more likely developed as caterpillars.
Did that work?
Yes, that worked. And we actually could narrow it a lot into Western Europe countries, including France, Portugal, UK and Ireland mostly.
So you'll say these started off as caterpillars in Europe. They somehow flew, presumably, at some point to West Africa, where they picked up the pollen that you discovered, and then they flew somehow across the vast expanse of the Atlantic to be picked up by you.
Exactly like that, yes. So in total, a trip of more than 7,000 kilometers, probably. Across Europe, across the Mediterranean Sea, across the Sahara Desert, and finally across the Atlantic.
Blown that way, Gerard and his team established by some strong transatlantic winds. Gerard Talavera is at the Barcelona Botanical Institute. Go to Nature Communications for the full details of his detective work. You can find a link to that on the programme webpage at bbcworldservice.com. How time flies. That's it for Science in Action this week. The producer was Jonathan Blackwell. I'm Roland Pease. Next week, we're heading to the Royal Society Science Summer Festival.